You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There are about 50,000 invasive species in this country, plants, insects, fish, and animals whose lives were once limited to specific regions, but that have spread into new territories enabled by global trade and the effects of climate change. Some of these invaders, like the Asian carp, zebra mussel, feral hog, lionfish, and the Asian longhorn beetle, damage or displace native species, causing considerable economic and environmental damage. Invasive species, from giant snails to Asian carp, alien wildlife is on the move, is an article by Time magazine senior writer Brian Walsh. It's, in fact, the cover story for the magazine's July 28th issue, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Walsh back to our show.
Hello. It's good to be here.
Hasn't this sort of thing been happening since humans first began to move from one place to another?
It has, really. I mean, it's been happening even before that. I mean, species always sort of move around, look for better habitat. What's really different is our ability to change the planet and to move things on a much grander scale than we ever would have had before.
So it sped up in recent years.
Exactly, yeah.
And when did it start becoming a discernible problem in this country?
In this country, I think it's really over the last few decades. I mean, it's been happening for quite some time, but when you think about the sort of real huge increase, say, in international trade, you're bringing in not just actual live animals. You know, people bring in exotic pets, things like that, that can sometimes get loose, which has happened a few times in the past. But sometimes things just hop a ride on shipping, for instance. I mean, you mentioned, I think, the zebra mussels, which are a big invasive species in the Great Lakes. They came most likely in the ballast water carried in a big container ship going from its origin somewhere in Eurasia to the Great Lakes, just came that way.
As rats traveled around the world, brought by ships.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, black rats are a good example. I mean, you don't need to have, you know, transcontinental flights or things like that. You had sailing ships, and they were able to sort of bring those creatures to new islands.
I suspect that there are all sorts of plants and animals that we consider to be indigenous, mm-hmm. for example, to the New York City area, that actually are invasive species.
Right. I mean, that's the really interesting thing. You know, if a species is here long enough, even if it's technically invasive, we tend to think of it as being native. I mean, one example just in the United States is the honeybee, which is actually something we've talked about before. You think it's about as American as could possibly be. Of course, it's actually the European honeybee. It came with settlers and spread very successfully around the country. Now, of course, you know, we're worried that it's actually going to disappear, not that it's going to be here.
There were 67 live African giant snails seized at the Los Angeles airport, intended for human consumption. Would we call them an invasive species?
We would call them an invasive species. They can cause some problems. They actually eat stucco. I mean, they'll actually eat the walls out of certain buildings. And, of course, they also hunt smaller species
as
well.
In L.A., that would be very bad.
It would be
very
bad.
There's a lot of stucco in L.A.
Yeah, I know. In L.A. and in Florida as well, yeah.
So who eats giant African snails?
I mean, apparently it's, I think, immigrants from that region. For them, of course, it's not an invasive species. It's something they, you know, might have had growing up. And now, of course, you can easily bring them into the U.S., and sometimes they get loose.
Is consumption a common cause for importing invasive species?
It can be. I mean, for instance, with the Asian carp, they weren't actually bred. Oh, actually, even better one is the snakehead fish. This is a fish that, native to Asia, popular for use in, I think, a lot of Asian cuisine, but particularly nasty. It's gotten out a few times, actually been released a few times on purpose. That's gotten out that way. So consumption's definitely a big part of this as well.
Well, the giant African snails come from what part of Africa?
They come from West Africa.
And what threat do they pose to the ecosystem?
I mean, they're similar to a lot of invasive species in that they are basically able to outcompete natives. So smaller snails, they'll actually be able to sort of take over their habitat, take over their food supply, and crowd them out. And that's what we see often with the most successful invasive species, is that they essentially just are better at competing with the natives and end up sort of crowding them out.
Well, we were talking about the zebra mussels. Can we eat them?
Not all that great. I mean, they're sort of, if you've ever seen them, they kind of gather in gigantic clumps along anything, really. Anything in the water, you know, it could be a ship's hull. A big problem is, of course, they gather in big clumps in the water intake valves in factories and power plants, and that's where they cause the real damage. And they can cause, you know, millions of dollars of damage to a power plant simply because they wreck the ability to bring in water.
What kinds of steps have people taken to prevent the Asian carp from invading the Great Lakes? Because that is a major concern. What would happen if they got into the Great Lakes?
Well, people think that if they got into the Great Lakes, and of course, we should say that there's some evidence that, you know, a few fish have gotten into the Great Lakes. It doesn't seem as if they've actually established themselves as a population yet. But they're very they're huge eaters. I mean, they're just ravenous eaters, so they would actually be displacing, I think, the food chain. They would be outcompeting native species. But there's one other particular thing. There's a particular species of the Asian carp called the silver carp, and they have a habit of actually leaping out of the water when they hear motorized boats. Now, for a different story, actually, a few years ago, I went to Illinois, where they're actually already very present in the rivers. It was something called the Redneck Fishing Tournament, where you actually have people drive around in big motorized boats and with nets. They take the nets out and try to capture the carp as they're jumping out. Of course, the big problem is that sometimes the carp will actually ram into you, and these are like, you know, 15, 20-pound fish traveling quite quickly. They can definitely hurt.
Especially since you're moving at the
same time.
Exactly.
You're moving forward. They're coming at you. It's not a really good situation.
Now, why did the Asian carp wind up being so successful in the Mississippi River? That's where they have thrived. In fact, it's been suggested that the Chicago Canal be closed to cut off access to the Great Lakes.
Exactly. So the carp came over. They were imported by fish farmers, actually, in the Midwest. They're very good at sort of cleaning out the bottoms of fish tanks. And they got loose, most likely, in a flood sometimes. So actually, it would have connected them to the river. And then over time, they just, you know, they're a very successful species. They're very good at eating. They could eat almost anything. And so they make their way up towards the Great Lakes. And the reason why they're thinking about trying to close that canal, and they already have something called an electric fence, which is designed to keep them out, but that's been variably successful. If you keep that canal open, you're sort of connecting two bodies of water that naturally shouldn't be together. I mean, the Mississippi River system and the Great Lakes. So it would be a very extreme action to take to actually close that off. I mean, they've had that for 100 years. A lot of ship traffic goes across it, but you know, if you do that, you would definitely make sure that carp would not get into the lakes.
So they were brought in to solve a problem. And hasn't that happened a number of times? I'm thinking of the cane toads of Australia who were brought in to solve a problem and wound up becoming a much bigger problem.
Right. That's a famous example, of course, the cane toads brought in. And, of course, they just took over in Australia. And I think that sort of points to how unpredictable nature can be. You know, you really can't easily just bring in one species to deal with another species as if it's a, you know, subtraction. You put that into it, it becomes an X factor in nature, and you never know what's going to happen.
My guest is Brian Walsh. His article in Time Magazine's July 28th issue was Invasive Species from Giant Snails to Asian Carp, Alien Wildlife is on the Move. You focus on Florida in your article. Why are invasive species so prevalent there?
I mean, a lot of reasons. For one thing,
can we blame the governor on that, Rick Scott?
I mean, he hasn't done enough to stop it, I suppose. But no, this definitely predates him. It's really the same reason that people love to go to Florida. The climate is great for a lot of tropical animals, especially. It's a huge port bringing in international traffic into the U.S. So you're getting a lot of live animals coming into Florida.
Are there things that aren't allowed in?
I mean, yeah. I mean, something like the snails, for instance, are actually, and that's the reason why they were actually seized at LAX. I mean, you have border officials actually looking here in the ports to try to see what's coming in, but you know, they don't have anywhere near the ability to check everything coming in, so a lot can get through.
And I'm sure that smuggling can be a problem here.
Oh, absolutely, it can be a problem. Yeah,
Burmese pythons have become a problem in Florida. How did so many of them end up in the wild?
Well, the thing is, they most likely were pets that were released accidentally.
People like to have pythons as
there
pets.
Are some people who like to have pythons, definitely. Not me personally, but they get out, and then it turns out they're just very good at living in South Florida. It's the perfect kind of environment for them. The weather's right. Once you get into the Everglades, there's a lot of place to hide, a lot of prey to seize. And so we don't actually know how many pythons there could be. There could be a few thousand. There could be 100,000 because they're almost impossible to actually find.
In this case, they have found an environment that's suitable for them. Do we ever see cases where these invasive species adapt to the environment?
Well, I mean, you could argue that when we talk about those invasive species that actually have been here for a long time and actually sort of take a role in nature, you could say they've adapted well. You know, I think one big part of the story is that there are so many invasive species happening right now, and we're having such a big impact on the planet that you have to sort of differentiate between those that are really pests, say the Asian carp, which they cause a huge problem to the environment, to the economy, and those that might settle all right and might actually make that big a difference to wildlife and to the human economy either.
And you called the Everglades an invasive free-for-all.
Well, absolutely. And that's in part because, again, the Everglades is just a welcoming tropical environment, but also because it's been so chopped up by human development. I mean, it's about half the size that it used to be. You now have people living right side by side with wildlife. And if you've ever been down there, you see those kind of roadside zoos where you have all sorts of exotic animals. And so it's very easy for them to get out. And once they're out, it's very easy for them to find a place to live. And that human-wildlife interface is so close that you really just have people keep resupplying new and new exotic animals there.
Is it inevitable that some very aggressive species like the Asian carp or jellyfish, we've talked about that in the past, will outcompete whatever is there in the place they're invading?
I think that's definitely a risk. You know, there are some biologists who believe that invasive species are the second biggest threat to endangered species around the world after just losing habitat. And it, we definitely see there are some species that just are very good at surviving and very good at pushing out other natives that, you know, they've been in that environment for a long time, but they may just be more sensitive or frankly, less adaptable.
Has climate change made the problem worse?
I think definitely it does, because it definitely sort of mixes up the habitats and climates that these species can live in. So you suddenly have a situation where maybe, you know, a state is warmer than it used to be. That means an invasive species that is more suited to that kind of warmer environment can move there, where a native species that's been there for a long time suddenly finds itself displaced not only by that new invasive species, but literally by the climate it's used to living in.
Have any diseases been brought in by invasive species?
I don't know any specific diseases that are brought in by invasives. I mean, definitely there's a risk that they can bring illnesses that can sometimes affect other plants or animals, for instance. You know, there are fungi that I think that have been coming in over on invasive plants that can then spread that way. And that's definitely another situation with climate change as well, because that can change the climate, can often spread some of those diseases.
How do you fight these things then?
It's really difficult. I mean, you know, the government spends billions of dollars in different ways trying to deal with invasive species. Often you're actually going for outright eradication. You might actually be trying to kill or poison some of those species. You definitely do a lot when it comes to prevention. You try to sort of control on the border, prevent the problem from getting worse. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's if you're talking about a really successful invasive species, especially if it's, you know, a certain kind of plant or a smaller animal or something like the python that's just hard to find, you know, it's probably you're not going to be able to stop it, really.
What about kudzu in Appalachia? Has that been tamed?
That has not been tamed. I mean, all you have to do is go down there and you can see it's spread all over the place.
It's killing off trees.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, that's an example that's happening. There's another one in Florida. We saw the Brazilian pepper tree actually brought in because it's an ornamental. Looks good, but it tends to sort of be so successful, just shades out native species.
And then I read in the paper the other day that the George Harrison tree that was planted in Los Angeles is being killed off by beetles. Now, I don't know if they, which is kind of ironic, but I don't know if they are invasive beetles or not.
It could be. I mean, you know, you have a number of different beetles and insects that attack trees that are. I mentioned one that's one on the cover, actually. That's the emerald ash borer. You know, you're talking about billions of ash trees are potentially at risk from this insect, and they just bore in there and kill them.
Can we call diseases invasive species as well? For example, when we look at an outbreak of Ebola that was once in one small area and now is spreading to a number of countries in Africa and could very well spread to the United States and Europe.
It's exactly
the
same.
Or anywhere else.
Yeah, it's exactly the same kind of principle. You have an organism, in this case a virus, gets out of its habitat, moves into a new one, and starts wrecking havoc, really. Any kind of infectious disease sort of works in the same kind of principle.
Can we say that humans are the ultimate invasive species and the ones who have the ability to do the most damage to the environment?
Absolutely. I mean, human beings have gone from their origins to spread to every climate, virtually every remotely possibly habitable land spot in the world. And even those areas where they don't live, of course, like the oceans, we have an enormous effect on them. So we've displaced a lot of species along the way. We're displacing a lot more. So there's really no other species better than us when it comes to doing this.
Well, we're thinking of trying to get rid of the Asian carp. I think it's a little harder when you try to get rid of humans.
Yeah, we're not likely to get rid of humans anytime soon, I think. And, you know, a lesson from the story really is that, you know, we're not going to go put species all the way back to where they used to be, because the truth is we don't know. This process of change certainly has accelerated in recent years, but it's always been a part of living on Earth.
How damaging is the Asian longhorn beetle? Is that being controlled?
It's an attempt at being controlled, and often I think we saw actually with the colder winter we had this past year was actually very helpful in kind of controlling that sort of insect. But that's, again, reminds us of the fact that in the future, with climate change, we're likely to get warmer winters. Insects like that will be much harder to kill off. There's one called the Rocky Mountain beetle, actually, which is not invasive, but has really been able to expand its range because of warmer winters and is just wrecking havoc on the trees up around the Rocky Mountains.
And the only thing you can do is to try to poison them?
You can try to poison them. I mean, you can try to make sure that no more get in there. But I think, you know, you're looking for a very effective insecticide. But, of course, any problem is when you do that, actually, you run the risk of causing some collateral damage along the way.
My great thanks to you for cheering me up today. Brian Walsh is a senior writer at Time magazine. His article, Invasive Species from Giant Snails to Asian Carp, Alien Wildlife is on the Move, is in the July 28th issue of Time magazine. Thanks.
Thank you very much.